If you are a midlife woman who's frustrated because you're trying to lose body fat, but what you've done in the past is no longer touching that muffin top. Perhaps you're struggling to manage your sugar cravings or evening snacking. You want to build muscle, stay active, and be mobile well into your later years. Well, listen, I have been in your shoes and can share a program with coaching and accountability to keep you on track with daily at-home workouts and macro-based meal plans that produce sustainable results. All you need to do is decide that you are worth it and that you want to control the narrative. And how do I know this will work for you? I was a client and loved my results so much that I became a coach. Just go to the show notes of this episode and let's connect. I'd love to tell you more and work with you as your certified coach. Now, on to the show. Health, wellness, fitness, relationships, and everything in between. We're removing the taboo from what really matters in midlife. I'm your host, Michelle Folan, and this is Asking for a Friend. When was the last time you went to the doctor and felt like you had a true champion in your corner? Someone rooting for you, but not only to improve your biomarkers and lose weight, but a healthcare provider who gets excited for your health wins and encourages you to live your healthiest life, not just in words, but by example. Meet Dr. Tolu Olabinton. She is the fangirl we all need to cheer when we win and pick us up when we don't cross the finish line. Welcome to Asking for a Friend, Dr. Tolu Olabinton.
Oh, thank you so much for having me on. I'm honored and delighted to be on.
Well, and I heard you on another podcast, and I love your approach. And so I thought this would be a great opportunity for you to talk a little bit about what you do. But first of all, I would love for you to tell the audience a little bit about where you're from and your career path.
I am originally from Nigeria. I was born there in the western part, and I lived there till I was 15 and I moved here. My parents' idea was to have me come here and get a better education, and he had friends here who had encouraged the transition. And so parents brought me over. I've always known I'd like to take care of people. So at first I thought maybe nursing would be for me because I like their uniforms better. But then I saw that it was the doctors that told the nurses what to do. And I was like, you know what? I think I like that one better. So medicine became a natural longing or something I worked towards. And then I lost my aunt. She was in her 20s, shortly after her wedding, to an asthma attack.
Oh, my goodness.
And so I think that I remember that day. That kind of sealed it for me. Not like that. No, I want to do medicine. There has to be a better way. And care has always been something that defined me. So I like caring for people. I like to be part of the equation to help someone feel better, even if it's a little bit. And so medicine allows me to do that as part of my job. And so did high school, did the sciences, did undergrad, pre-med, biochem, took a year break, and then went to medical school. And then here we are. How many years later now? Since med school, about 17, 18 years later. I'm still doing medicine.
Did you go through the citizenship process?
Yes, I did. That was interesting. Initially, it was not the plan. It was just to do studies and then go back. But it worked out this way. And then, yes, I am a citizen here now.
What was that process like for you? To go through the citizenship process, be studying, going through your residency, all that stuff. I mean, you were super busy. How did that all work within your life?
I'll be honest with you, the initial cultural shocks were adapting to a new culture that is more expressive and more, it was tough, I'll be honest with you. I grew up in a culture where, you know, you couldn't talk back to elders. You respected the elderly by virtue of their age, not because of their social ranking. You're not really allowed to fully express your thoughts. You had to curtail it to the circumstances you were in. And then coming here and I recount one of the One of the worst days of my life to date, there was a student, it was high school, my first year here, and she told the teacher to shut up, and I got up with holy indignation. How the heck, like, how dare you? Because to me, that was, I mean, even now, I cringe, but not as much as I did then. I was, and I think that was the day I committed what I call social, like, I was like, how could you talk to her like that? That was so rude. And so, of course, I was ostracized. You don't do that. So just learning the environment that was different. And, you know, I grew up in an environment where I was well known, and so come to a new place. But one of the things that has helped me do is to understand people better and be in their shoes better when they're uncomfortable, or where they feel they stand out, or where they feel, you know, I don't belong. So it's helped me be who I am today, those experiences. Were there challenges? Yes, but life is full of challenges. It's guaranteed to have challenges. You just make the most of it. And for me, being a doctor is much more than a career path. It's a calling. So you do the things needed to get there. And yeah. I had a good support system, I'll be honest with you, through each phase, through each season on my way here. Yes.
Well, and I know your parents are there with you right now, and they must be so incredibly proud of you.
They are. They don't hide it well.
They don't hide it well. That's so nice. That's so nice. And by the way, I hope that we all try to raise our kids to be respectful of their elders. I know I have really tried, and you know, my kids are in their 20s, and it does break my heart when I see kids that are disrespectful. It just, you know, just wasn't the way we were raised, and I don't expect that type of behavior from my children either. So all we can do is do our best with, you know, those kids in our care, right?
I agree. And, you know, one of the things I find to be the truth is that I don't think people mean to be disrespectful. It's just we got to understand the implications of our verbal communications or our nonverbal cues. Like, I'm teaching my daughter, who's so excited to eager to grow up. And I said, when I say something to you and you eye roll and you do this, you're communicating disrespect. You don't mean to, or you're upset, but you are communicating. Like, you may not think you are. You are. And she's like, oh, I say, that's growing up. You're responsible for all your cues.
Yep. You know, yes, so. You are. Yes, you are. You know, one other thing, and this is just kind of a side note too, is I always try to be cognizant of when I'm having a conversation with someone and they're off, or, you know, they're in a mood, or they may not be treating me well. I try to think, you talked about putting yourself in someone's shoes. Did they have an argument with someone that day? Are they not feeling well? Did they have a death in the family? You know, you try to think about all the extenuating circumstances that can make somebody not behave in a normal or acceptable manner. So, more about you. I was excited to talk with you because I think it's good to get insight into how a doctor practices what they preach. So, you're giving a lot of advice and encouragement to your patients. But what do you do in your personal life that you feel helps you, again, put yourself in your patient's shoes?
So being human, and I'm a doctor, but I'm a human too. And I emote, I have feelings. I also want to be appreciated. I want to be loved. I want to do better in my health. I want to live a good quality of life. So, you know, between learning in medicine and learning even after going to school, I've committed to continuing to learn ways to improve the quality of life for people. Now, my niche is doing this on the platform of sincere care. I believe in helping people live a better quality of life and quantity of life, because I believe how well you live is just as important as how long you live. And so I've seen what it feels like as a patient, and even watching or having patients over the years tell me how they felt, either at a practice I was at, how they felt belittled on their way in, or how they felt they were talked down or talked at. I've gone to doctor's offices where people don't know what I do, heard them talk about other patients, and just feel like a number or an inconvenience. And so I know that people thrive best, or they heal well, when they know that they are cared for, healing starts from that first impression. And so, you know, sometimes I come back to the clinic and I tell my team, like, I'm very happy that I work with you, because I just came from a clinic where I didn't feel so good on the way in, but I knew the doctor, she knows what I do, they don't know. And I don't ever want anyone to feel like that coming to our clinic. And so with that in mind, it's helped me curate an atmosphere at my practice that from the minute you walk in, oh, you are excited to be there. From the colors, the music, the smile. Because even if in the clinic we can't change your medical diagnosis, oh, you leave knowing that you were cared for, and that adds value to you. It's a ripple effect that ripples even in their world. I've seen it happen over and over and over again. People just feel better. Like, you know what? I came here. I felt listened. I felt heard. In the end, if I'm honest, as a physician, I didn't know much. I listened to you. I encouraged you in your journey. Like, it seemed like that was a burden you took bear, but you don't have to be miserable through it. Here are things that add a little sparkle to your life. And it's not all about, let's act like everything's all rosy-dosy. It's like you have to live. You're living through this. So how can we make it a little better for you? A little bit. Those experiences have helped me know what I don't. And, you know, it's so funny. I never thought I'd open my own practice. Never thought that. But I used to imagine, like, yeah, that's something I wouldn't do. You know how you say, as a mom, yeah, I'm not going to do that when I'm a parent. I'm not going to do that when I'm a parent.
Yeah.
Well, I know, it's funny that I do some of them now as a parent. But it had a running, almost like a running play in my mind that, nah, if I ever were to have a place, you know, my own, this I wouldn't allow, or this I will allow. We got to do a better job of showing people care. Mm-hmm. It takes effort. It takes intentionality. I have a morning routine that I don't negotiate. I have to pray. I center myself. And I have to draw strength for my relationship with God. My faith is big because I can't pour from an empty cup. I can't.
Right.
Yeah.
What other things do you do that you feel are a good example to your patients?
I read books. I listen to books. I'm constantly learning new ways that people can live better. I'm also lifestyle boarded. I keep adding more titles to my, not titles, but more knowledge to my old reminders, you know. And I also practice the things I'm talking about. I try new fruits and vegetables that I don't enjoy. I blend them, I freeze them, I chomp them, I slurpy them. Same way I tell the patients too. I make water a drink of choice for myself. So I drink water. I have a water bottle at my office that reminds me. I encourage my team. I reward people with fruits and veggies. And then I'm also very big on my thought life. I guard my mental space as best as I can. You know, the things I listen to are things I say to myself. And I say to patients and tell them to go watch and be reminded who they are, their value, their worth. Sad sometimes people may not recognize that, but you have to do that for yourself. So I exercise. I do a prayer walk every morning, most mornings for almost an hour. And I agree with team members. I'm not always excited to exercise. I don't enjoy the gym. People look stressed in there. They look angry. I go there, take a machine, do a little cute when I'm doing my thing and play with some machines. And so I keep it real. So I do the things I tell my patients to do. And we talk about the different textures and I don't like that. I'm like, yeah, I agree, but I know it's good for me. So I do it anyway.
Yeah. You know?
Yeah.
Yeah. And it's hard. I mean, well, first of all, you're leading by example, but not just with your patients, with your staff. So if they see you treating patients in a certain way, they will see that. And I believe they'll emulate that. So I think that's super positive and something that you're doing really well. In terms of the food and that sort of thing, you're having to break habits that you may have a patient that's not had a great diet for 75 years. And all of a sudden you're trying to change that paradigm of, hey, it's never too late to change up the diet. And so I think that's one of those, well, good luck with that.
You know what's so interesting? Everyone is capable of change. Doesn't matter how old you are. It's when you see what's in it for you to the point where you're like, you know what? I'm willing to change for that. And a lot of times people say things like, oh, in my family, diabetes runs. In my family, this. Once I can get them to see, well, it may not be the actual disease. It may be the actual habit that runs in the family that you could break the cycle. They're like, that's true. And then they see it, they feel better, and they're like, you know what? It's worth it. So It became, oh man, medicine has changed me, has taught me a lot, and has changed me too. I used to be very like, oh, labs are better. Yay. Your A1C is great. Oh, your cholesterol, my goodness. And the patient is like, okay, good for you. Now I'm like, how do you feel? Your joints, you're eating more fresh fruits and vegetables, your number has come down. How do you feel? Do you have more energy? Are you sleeping better? Your skin, it looks better. And they're like, oh yeah. So sometimes you just got to remind you people that what they're doing is working to keep them encouraged, to keep retaining these new habits. What's in it for you? It's not about my computer looking cute. No.
Right.
So that's the trick. That's one of the tricks I share with you there.
They may not understand the numbers, but the numbers may be a direct reflection of, like you said, how they feel, how they look. Oh my goodness, I was able to take 3 laps around the neighborhood yesterday, and I haven't done that in years, right? You brought up something interesting, Dr. O, when you were talking about maybe it's not your family history so much, your family's health history, it may be the habits. And we've had that discussion before on the podcast. It's kind of that chicken or the egg. Do we inherit the bad lifestyle? Is it truly inheriting the genetics? And maybe it's a combination of both. I think that's an interesting perspective that you have.
Yes, it's a combination. And now we're starting to understand something called epigenetics, that though you don't change your genetic makeup, you can actually not alter your genes, but tease your genes in a way that it works more for you than against you by changing your habits. We're starting to see that. And so the truth is, when I'm helping you eat better and saying I want to prevent a heart attack, you don't know the effects of what I've done down the line, but it's not worth trying to find out. There are many things that have been established over centuries that eating well, a plant-based diet for the most part, that exercise and seated, standing, whatever type, is good for you, right? And so I still encourage people to make that effort to change your lifestyles, to eat better, regardless of what their family history shows. Some people say, well, I'm doomed to this anyway because my father had this or my mother had this. But I've had patients outlive their parents, their grandparents. I've had them outlive stats. I've had people who have strong family history of dementia by some of their lifestyle changes actually reduce their risk. So it's the science is showing that does happen. So let's not lean on any. It's not going to work anyway. It could be a family habit, not a family history, health history. It's a family habit that's just passing down the line that needs to be broken.
That was going to be one of my questions. Are there current recommendations for dementia and Alzheimer's prevention?
Sadly, once someone has dementia, it's hard to reverse right now, depending on the type. Now, there's some is pseudo dementia, so depression, or there's a thyroid issue, or there's a B12 deficiency, or there's some electrolyte imbalance, or there's something that could be reversed to correct that. Or someone had a stroke, or someone had multiple strokes that were not caught. But we know for certain that certain things minimize or reduce the risk of dementia happening. Exercising is one. Eating fresh fruits and vegetables is another. Limiting exposure to too much electronics is another. Learning something new is another. Having a good social network, even if they're superficial interactions, those are very helpful too. And then doing things that are in line with your purpose, what you believe your purpose is actually known to minimize the risk of dementia. So we know that, but the sweet spot is in the prevention, and it's doing it consistently, right? And so we encourage our patients to do that, even as we're discovering more and more new modalities and treatment for dementia.
You know, I posted something on my story the other day, and I can't remember who it was, but they were talking about just doing 10,000 steps a day can lower your risk of dementia by, it was like 50%. I mean, it was a huge number. So I reposted it because it doesn't have to be an hour and a half at the gym sweating your brains out. It can be 8,000 to 10,000 steps a day of just walking that can make such a huge impact. So that's really interesting, the correlation there with dementia. There is a lot of coaching going on there right now about sugars in our diet. And I want to ask you how you're addressing the extra sugar that people are getting in their diet and your practice.
I have a post called sugar, 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 sugar. Because, you know, there's the brown sugar, the blue sugar, the green sugar. Like, oh, I'm eating healthier sugar. Like, it's all sugar. And for my sweet tooth patient, I feel the most for them because, you know, if you have a sweet tooth, that's tough. But understanding that the sugar, the high corn fructose syrup that's embedded in a lot of fruits, oh, not fruits, but a lot of foods, are placed there by what we call food engineering to keep you hooked on it. So I tell my patient, I don't want you to be a sucker. Like, I want you to know what's in it. So if you're going to eat it, you know that, okay, I'm drinking this can of soda, this small can that has 48 grams of sugar. Now, 5 grams of sugar is 1 teaspoon. So I'm essentially saying I'm going to chow down about, 48 divided by 5, about almost 10 teaspoons of sugar as a little snack. Yeah. So it's opening my patient's eyes to say, this is what you're doing. Now, if you like soda, that's tough. And I tell them, oh, I can understand. I drink soda once a year, usually with a burger, once a year as well. I open it. I take a sip and I'm like, man, this is
there's nothing better.
Good. And then I remember my why. I want to be 90. I look back on how I've blessed this planet. Be surrounded by family and friends, knowing that I've done what God has asked me to do. And still able to tell people, hey, you got to behave. And still be able to do the things that matter to me. So this soda, not worth it. It's rehashing that conversation in different pieces. And a lot of my posts on social media is just the debacle as a human, fighting cravings and urges. You know, you're tired. You want something to soothe. You go for a soda. You go for something that's really sweet. So I teach them, what else can you do outside of food to self-soothe, to give yourself a hug after a long day? Maybe read a book. That's what actually got me reading more books, because I like to eat. As much as I'm a physician, I'm a foodie too. I enjoy eating. But I eat healthy, but there are days where I'm tired and I tend to make poor choices. So it's, let me address your, what's going on? What are alternatives? I've also taught my patients about dried fruits. Strawberries, they're sweeter, right? When they're dehydrated, or maybe drinking a little water, or freezing your chocolate so it can thaw, and put some music, you know, let it melt your mouth. Like, don't multitask when you're eating. Enjoy the chocolate. You may not have to eat as much, you know, so it's keeping it real. Before, I used to be, no, don't do this, don't do this. I'm like, you know what? That's not reasonable. How can I help you make better choices? And every day is a new conversation. You know, I'll share this story. I had a patient once who got really upset with me because the first day I met her, I told her to stop Dr. Pepper. She was diabetic. Of course, I'll tell her to stop Dr. Pepper. And she said, you just met me. I love Dr. Pepper. I've had a long-term relationship with Dr. Pepper for decades. And you just, and I was like, you know what? I'm sorry. Can we cut it down to sweet tea, half and half? So we negotiated by doing the math. So it's many people where they are and little steps. I never giving up on people. Just, I never getting tired of doing that. Because some days I'm like, are you listening? Like, yeah. Like, please.
Yeah, I've tried this managing a group of people. If you give them some buy-in, give them some, a little power in the relationship, then you're likely to get some behavioral change. You're a genius. Instead of saying, you can't do this, you can't do this, you can't do this, it's like, well, can we compromise? Let's meet in the middle somewhere. And that's such a great start, right? I mean, we talk about sugar a lot on this platform. And I think we had a pharmacist on, and she was saying that the new American Heart Association maximum for women grams of sugar a day was 25 grams of sugar, added sugar. And when you look at what is just in a grande latte from Starbucks, or like you said, a 12-ounce can of soda, you've already surpassed that. And it's really trying to make that a visual for people so that they understand how much sugar is really in their food that they're eating.
Yes. Even in condiments. It's sugar and ketchup. I love it. I'm like, ah.
Yeah. I was having this conversation with a family member who has psoriasis. And I mentioned to him, I said, there is a correlation there with high sugar intake. It can aggravate your psoriasis. And he's like, wait, I have a bowl of Fruit Loops every night before I go to bed. I said, oh, you might want to cut that out because that's really not doing you any favors. But Anyway, it baby steps, right, Dr. O? Just right. That's it's right. It's right. Baby steps. Most of my listeners are midlife women. And I think we've talked a little bit already about how do we best prepare ourselves to be a healthy 80 years old. But right now, when we go to our healthcare provider, what blood work should we be asking for? Because sometimes I think we need to kind of be in the driver's seat when it comes to managing our care.
And I'll be honest with you, most doctors don't have a hard time or, you know, with ordering a test. It's just insurance coverage. And you're getting a bill and you're getting upset. But I would say this, for the most part, at least get a CNP, so complete metabolic panel. Check your kidney function, your liver function, your electrolytes. Check your vitamin D, because that's very important, even for mental health, for bone health, and for kidney health. You want to check and screen for high cholesterol, because high cholesterol is linked to heart disease, linked to strokes. You want to also check your diabetes. You want to check for diabetes. Are you pre-diabetic? Are you diabetic? You want to know where you are on that spectrum, not just, oh, no diabetes. Well, are you close? You also want to check your thyroid function. And I tend to recommend that as a, because it's a metabolic hormone that regulates how quickly you burn calories, you affect your temperature regulation as well. And I like to do the thyroid, like the specific ones, not just the thyroid TSH with reflex. There's a reflex pattern. I like to look at the T3, the T4s, the TSH, and see if there's something that's a little slowed. So those are the basic ones I tend to recommend. There are more specific ones that check for cholesterol. I also recommend your blood levels too, your CBC, so your complete blood count. Are you anemic? Is there something that's eating at the blood cells? For a menstruating woman, I recommend iron screen too, an iron test, just to make sure that you're having enough iron reserves, because that's important too for your blood cell formation, which is important for carrying oxygen to different organs in the body. Now, those are typically blood tests. They're, of course, imaging testings, you know, colon cancer screening, checking your prostate as a man, but you're not a man, so you're going to switch off. Then the other slews of tests, depending on what your concerns are, but that has to be personalized. And a lot of questions I always like to ask or encourage patients to ask when they ask for tests is, what would you do when you get this result? So it helps guide how much you do. You know, what would you do? What would you be willing to change based on this information? Because once you know, what are you going to do based on this? So that helps guide. Sometimes I have patients who come, I want everything. And I'm like, oh, there are over 10,000 blood tests I could do. So,
yeah.
So you got to get loose. Like, what questions do you want to ask? Are you tired? Do you need to check your hormone levels? Do you need to check, you know, your cortisol levels?
Yeah, I appreciate you saying that about thyroid. Because I believe I actually, last time I went to the doctor, I asked her to do a more in-depth thyroid panel based on actually one of the guests on my podcast told me to do that. And she was like, yeah, sure. I don't always do that, but yeah, let's do it. And so that's why I was hoping to get some of that information from you, because I think that's important for us to direct traffic a little bit when it comes to our doctor's appointments.
I agree. It's your body.
Exactly. Absolutely. You know, when you have a midlife patient come in and they're complaining about not being able to sleep, or they're super stressed out, you know, they feel like they're kind of amped up anxiety. And, you know, we know some of that can be menopause. How do you coach a patient through sleep and stress and anxiety questions?
So I ask them, when you feel the way you do, what are you thinking? And sometimes they're like, what do you mean? I'm stressed. I'm like, before I see you the next time, can you just think, like, what thoughts? I'm afraid I won't sleep well. I'm afraid I have a lot of things to do. I'm afraid that I forgot to do some. I'm afraid. I tell them to pen it down. Like, write it down. Because it actually helps you take stock of what needs to be addressed. And then we could talk about, okay, you're going through a stressful time at your job. What are things we could do? And so I say things like, how about you do a brain dump an hour before you go to bed? Let's do a to-do list. What are things you're afraid you're going to forget? Let's write it down. I encourage journaling. I used to think that was a silly thing to do, but oh my goodness, I journal every day. So, but I do it intentionally. It's not just scribbling. It's more, what am I thankful for throughout the day? So what that does to my brain is to tell my brain that there are things that are working in the day, but because my brain naturally would not tell me like, hey, this worked. Things are not bad. It's only going to show the things that are stress inducing for whatever reason. I don't know. And so that helps me as I'm training my brain to be more positive during the day. I'm less stressed because I see the things that are working. But for the sleep part, I say brain dump. So things to do, things I'm grateful for. And then I do this exercise where I reinvent my future by imagination. And I tell my patients to do the same thing too. I said, the worst case scenario, you get a good sleep. They're like, well, you're setting yourself up for failure and what's false hope. I'm like, I get a good sleep. It's worth it. All right. And so the other things are, especially as women, we don't prioritize sleep. Oh my gosh. It's like whatever is left of the day, I'll do. But I remind my patients, women, one, a lot of people are tied to you. You don't want to not do this for this person. You want to be there for this person. Well, you need to rest to be able to carry the weight of taking care of all the people you care about. Number two, when you sleep, you allow your brain to excrete things, toxins. That's a necessary process, and it only happens during good sleep. And you wake up refreshed, and you're actually able to think of good ideas for problem solving. Right?
Yeah.
And then an hour before you plan to go to bed, like condition your atmosphere. And it's not only you trying to sleep. Everybody needs to know you're trying to sleep. So phones are off. Electronics are off. Your phone is on do not disturb. Only those people who need to get through to you can allow. Lights dim. You know, blackout curtains are in place so that you can really reset to sleep. And then try to pee. So those are things, but it varies. And a lot of it, patients or people are like, oh my God, I have things to do. I'm like, there's never going to be a time where you have absolutely nothing to do. So stop. It's not possible. There will always be something to do.
Yeah, I think for me, it's planning my day the night before. So I make a list of all the things that I need to get done so that I can go to bed knowing that I have a plan. So I love your suggestions. I think that's, I'm going to try some of the things that you just suggested. What do you think about alcohol?
I personally don't drink. That's a personal choice, more a consecration type thing for me. But it depends. Why do people drink? So I have people who drink themselves to sleep, you know, to help them relax. So one has to be very careful. The recommendations for a woman is no more than 5 ounces of wine. And those big glasses that you can go like this with, that is not 5 ounces.
No, I know.
So it's why is it more a habit or is it something like, I have people who use it to sleep, who use it to relax. They can't sleep without alcohol. And I'm like, that's a concern. Now, there's also the argument that, oh, it contains antioxidants and, you know, grapes and the amount needed for it to actually be clinically relevant, you have to drink more than like a lot. And at that point, it's not worth it. So drink at your discretion. It's not medicinal. I don't believe it's fully medicinal. Just get grapes.
Yeah.
Make sure you're also finding out like why that's important. Like, can you do without it? And that's when I, you know, like, no, I get the shakes or I feel restless. And I'm like, can I help with sleep? So that's an option. So alcohol becomes an option for you, not a necessity. So that's the difference, option versus necessity. If it becomes a necessity, then I get a little concerned. You know, what's going on with your liver? Too much of it, your blood pressure, your protein intake. Yeah.
Okay. If you could influence your patients to do just one thing, what would it be?
Upgrade your thought life because, oh my gosh. You think possible, it's possible. You think I'm worthy of sacrificing or of avoiding certain foods to improve my well-being. You will, like, a lot of it stems from thoughts. So please be very intentional about your thought life and make efforts to upgrade it for every area of your life.
I love that. That can be so impactful to so many people. What is one of your most important pillars of self-care that you practice every day? Pray?
Oh, yes. I have got to pray.
Yeah.
That's a non-negotiable.
Yeah.
That's a non-negotiable. It's a big part of who I am.
Yeah.
My sleeping God, yes.
He's your partner.
Yes.
Yeah.
Big time.
Yeah. You can't see Dr. O right now, but she is smiling ear to ear right now. Dr. O, you are delightful. Please tell the listeners where they can find you.
I am on the World Wide Web, www.livingspringmedicals.com. There's a point there where you can actually email me and I get emails directly. I also am on YouTube. If you Google my name, Tolope Olabinton, I have a YouTube channel, over 200 videos, just having discussions to help people live long and well. I've interviewed a lot of doctors and specialists across the globe, asking questions like I'm a patient. So there's a lot of resource there. I'm also on Facebook. I'm on Instagram. I'm on TikTok, but not really. It's too addicting. So, but I'm on LinkedIn as well. So just put my name in Tolope Olabinton, and you'll find me.
Yeah, and just for everybody listening, I have checked out Dr. Olabinton's Instagram and her YouTube. She's very engaging, and you can tell she really does care about her patients, and which is why I had her on the show today. Thank you so much for being here. I will put all your contact information in the show notes and really appreciate it.
Thank you for the privilege. It was really an honor. Thanks.
Follow Asking for a Friend on social media outlets and provide a review and share this show wherever you get your podcasts. Reviews and sharing help us grow.